Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So, Matt, and have you heard about the population of Ireland?
No.
It's Dublin.
That's bad.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody. Matt, how are you doing tonight, brother?
Man, I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm exhausted from the holidays, but because we're recording this right after the holidays, but we had to do the, you know, you take down the fall decorations, put up the Christmas decorations, because it's now legally time that you can do that. If you've had it up before Thanksgiving, you're breaking the law. You have to wait till after Thanksgiving to put up Christmas decorations. I mean, it should be illegal at least, but,
Yeah.
So we did all that, went and bought the tree and everything. So I'm tired, but house looks like Christmas now.
Oh yeah. I put up the tree on Friday. Kids decorated it a day later, and, I'm worn out. It's not even Christmas yet.
Right. Well, we're to the point though now where it's like you're just ready for Christmas to get here so that you can enjoy the fruits of all this labor.
Does Elf on the Shelf come to your house?
Yes, he does.
He's been coming to mine for quite some time.
Yep. He comes here, and actually a couple nights ago, he wedged himself in a jar and farted in the jar and left a note for Michael that said, "I farted in here, smell it." And when you open it, for some reason elf farts smell like peppermint. I don't know. That's weird. I wish mine smelled like peppermint.
Oh, ours is not that that crass.
Yeah, he's been.
He might be this year, though.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's gotten used to coming here. He might be a little crass, but anyway.
That's it. Once they get used to it, you know. All right. So real quick, everybody go check out Podbelly Network, podbelly.com. We've mentioned it a lot now, but we're new members of the Podbelly Network, and we love it. Go to podbelly.com to get information about how to start a podcast if you want to, and to find a bunch of different podcasts in different genres that you might not find otherwise. The Sofa King podcast, Lost Boys of Hannibal, and Just the Worst podcast are all on the Podbelly Network. So go check them out if you have not yet. Like we do every year, we are doing our listener stories for Christmas. So we need you to send us your stories. Now, keep in mind, it can be a legitimate thing that happened to you, or it can be something, you know, one of your favorite, like, made-up stories. But remember, we can't read a novel. We do have a time frame. Y'all have to listen to Matt and I talk enough, so we don't need to extend it to a four-hour episode.
Right.
And please, in the email, title it Holiday Episode, Christmas Episode, something like that, so that we can find it easier, and give us permission, you know, in the email to either use your name or not, and just send us your story. You can email it to us, graveyardtalespodcast@gmail.com. Go to the website and enter it, or hit us up on Facebook, however you want to do it. But send those in. We got to have those in by December 15th to be able to get it out for the Christmas episode.
Right. And this is bringing back the tradition of telling ghost stories at Christmas, you know, around the fire on Christmas Eve, you know, sharing ghost stories has been an old Victorian tradition, and Adam and I are doing our best to bring it back. So send us those stories. Like I said, fictional, true, doesn't matter. If you've got a good story, send it in.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you want to kind of get an idea of what we're talking about, if you haven't, go back and listen to some of the other holiday episodes we've put out. And, you know, 1 year we had you send in your recordings of it. So 1 year you'll hear people telling their own story. And another year, Matt and I did it. Matt and I are going to read it out this year. So just type it out and send it to us.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to push real quick before we get into the episode is Hellier 2. Now, y'all probably remember when Hellier first came out, I was raving about it and I told y'all to go watch it. If you haven't, I don't know what's wrong with you. If you haven't, go watch it, because Hellier 2 just came out the day after Thanksgiving here in the U.S. And it is phenomenal. If you liked the first Hellier, you'll love this one. Matt and I were fortunate enough to get early watch on some of the episodes, and it just blew my mind what they were able to uncover and find this time. So definitely go check out Hellier 2. You can find it on Amazon Video. Just type in Hellier. Be sure to watch the first one before the second one if you haven't. But do that and then hit us up and let us know what you thought of it, because it ties into so much that Matt and I talk about, but also not. It's hard to explain. Just go check it out. I promise you, you'll like it. So that's my recommendation for this week, Matt. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight?
Okay. Tonight, Adam and I are going to take a look at one of the most intriguing and enigmatic figures of the early 20th century. A self-proclaimed magician, he scoffed at traditional society, and he sought out knowledge to learn the true nature of the human existence through rituals and the occult. By some, he's been called a visionary, a prophet, a teacher, but others called him a misogynist, a sex addict, and a self-absorbed egomaniac. But who was this man that would seek to summon demons, yet be credited as the founder of religion? This man, who would be called the wickedest man in the world. Join us tonight as we discuss Aleister Crowley.
This is going to be a good one.
Man, he is such a character.
Oh, I know. And he's come up so often in so many of our episodes, and every time Matt and I are like, we're going to do an episode on him one day. We're going to do an episode on him one day. And when we were looking at this episode to, you know, what were we going to do for this week? Matt brought up Aleister Crowley, and we were both like, yeah, you know, it's probably about time we did that, because he's poked his head into so much that we've done.
And so instead of just giving you just a biography lesson about his life and, you know, all this stuff, we're going to try to mix in. What's that?
We could do that. I mean, that's
we could.
That's history, and we could sit here and do it for hours.
Yeah, I mean, we really could, but we want to give you a little bit of his life history, but we really want to get into more of what he was all about and the teachings, you know, some of the writings that he did, where his focus was, what his purpose was, and some of the strange things that he was associated with and that happened after his death, because he was really influential. And I'm not talking about a bunch of just loonies just following somebody, just looking for somebody new to follow. I mean, these were intelligent, sometimes high-ranking.
Yeah, affluent.
People. Yes. Yes. That bought in to what Crowley was preaching. And it's pretty amazing, you know, that that he was able to do this and, you know, continue to influence people and their philosophy on life and, you know, the spiritual realm and the universe and everything. So,
yeah.
So Adam, let's tell us a little bit about, you know, Crowley's beginnings.
All right. I can do that. So the U.S. Grand Lodge has a lot of good information on Crowley if you're interested in diving a little deeper than what we do tonight. And that's where I got some of this information from. Edward Alexander Crowley was born in Leamington Spa in 1875. He was educated at Malvern and Trinity College, Cambridge, where he changed his name to Alistair. Now, he was a lyric and dramatic poet with several dozen books to his credit, including a collaboration with August Rodin. He is anthologized in the Oxford Book of English Mystical Verse. Now, Crowley was a natural polymath, and he made a name for himself as a poet, a novelist, journalist, a mountaineer, explorer, chess player, graphic designer, drug experimenter, a prankster, and yogi, magician, and prophet, and just so much more. He dabbled in so many things that I could keep going and take four more breaths before I finished what all he was known for. He's been compared to Sir Richard Burton, and Crowley is probably best known today as the author of the 20th century's most influential textbooks on occultism and as the first Englishman to found a religion, Thelema, which is today recognized as a faith all around the world. Now, Crowley was a member of many secret societies, including the renowned Golden Dawn, which we've talked about before, a place that harbored members as brilliant as Irish poet W.B. Yeats, who we've talked about before, and where he got to learn the hermetic corpus of Western magic, especially what is known as Solomonic magic, which is derived from King Solomon's method and supposedly was used to summon the spirits that helped him build his temple.
So, you know, Crowley, he had his own outlook on everything. It was odd, you know, he used a false name when he joined the Order of the Golden Dawn because he wasn't really sure. He already had a reputation, and he wasn't really sure that they would accept him as is. So as he became a more renowned member, then he kind of let the cat out of the bag.
Was his name Callister Rowley?
No.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I had the name that he used, but it was common. I don't
John
know
Smith.
I wrote it, but yeah, it was something. Well, it was
John Doe.
It was a little flowery, but it wasn't anything. Just, you know, it wasn't like a play on his own name. But either way,
Callister Rowley is good. I think we need that.
He was really good at rubbing people the wrong way. I mean, he knew how to get under people's skin, and a lot of it was just because he felt like things should be done a certain way, and, you know, the Order of the Golden Dawn was really more interested in communing with angels. Now, Crowley wanted to do that, for sure, but the way he went about it and what his end game was as far as communing with angels and astral beings was a little bit different. So ultimately, Crowley, he had a falling out with the Order of the Golden Dawn. And just a few years after his induction, he began to rebel against the leader, which was S.L. MacGregor Mathers. Now, his claims were that although he believed that Mathers did indeed have some mystical powers, that Mathers had begun to toy with evils that were well beyond his control. And this had caused irreparable damage to the order, which really Crowley said gave him no alternative but to leave. Now, the members of the order saw Crowley's exit a little bit differently. Now, his sexual orientation and his outlandish personality was really causing a problem among the other members. And Crowley had begun using psychedelic drugs to further heighten his experiences. And as the order members were typically abstaining members of high society, I mean, they were, like Adam said, they were affluent people. They didn't approve of this, and that caused even more problems. Now, members were strictly forbidden from paying one another to teach them spells. So Crowley got around this by offering free rent to another member in return for teaching him some of the more advanced spells.
There you go. That works. You're not selling anything.
Sounds like an episode of Sabrina, the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Well, know? It's like Sabrina
and
you're
not Friends. Ready to learn that yet.
Yeah. Sabrina and Friends matched up, you know, they got sharing an apartment.
Right. I'm going to let you live here for free, and you're going to teach me some of that freaky magic.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you mentioned the psychedelics. He was actually one of the first people to start using, one of the first people in Western culture to start using psychedelics along with magic to heighten his communing. It's been done for since the dawn of time through most of humanity, but Western societies, you know, like we've said before, we're kind of behind on a lot of that stuff, and we always think we know better and all that. Well, he was one of the first ones to start incorporating that.
Yeah. A real interesting read is he documented his conversation with the color purple. No, I'm kidding. That's a joke. That's kind of what you do with psychedelics, though.
Yeah, he smelled the color 9.
But because of all this and his personality, the order feared that as his influence in the group grew, that he would rise up the ranks and eventually take over. And so take that, and then you combine it with his interest in black magic, and they feared that if he got strong enough, that he would use his power for evil instead of good, which ultimately was the order's purpose.
Right.
Now, Crowley would actually be sued by the order for releasing secret writings from Mathers to the public.
A secret order can sue? A secret order can sue? I mean, that just seems weird to me.
Yeah, you know. You wouldn't want to go to court with your secret order.
Exactly.
You know? All our stuff's going to come out, man. We can't do this.
Yeah, who are you representing? this group that I can't talk about.
I can't tell you.
Yeah. You can't know, but I'm here on their behalf.
Why are they suing this guy? Well, we can't tell you that either. It's a secret. But, you know, there really wasn't a copyright on any of this. So Crowley won.
Yeah.
But that lawsuit pretty much ended his relationship with the order.
As most lawsuits do, yes.
I would say so. But after his falling out with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, Crowley went to Paris, and then he came to the Americas. Now, he did do some traveling in Mexico, and he found inspiration in what he discovered there, and he established his own order, the Lamp of the Invisible Light. Now, according to Crowley, his time in the Order of the Golden Dawn was really just a warm-up, and he compared his leaving the order to, he quotes, putting away childish things, and he set out to advance his knowledge on his own. So he learned to wield, dig this, the all-encircling chain of the Great Brotherhood and the sword of the Flaming Light.
That's
killing
a mouthful.
The serpent that had started the downfall of Christ, while taming good and evil bulls, sowing dragon's teeth, and acquiring the golden fleece.
Man, he was on the good stuff, wasn't he?
I read that. I was like, what? Wait.
I mean,
We've got Greek mythology in here. We've got biblical references in here. Where is he going with this?
It's an all encompassing group, apparently.
I'm telling you, it's pretty incredible. But while he was writing his self-initiation ceremonies for his new order, he also discovered how to make himself invisible, which, according to Crowley, is actually pretty easy.
I need to learn that.
I know. I'm like, okay, well, how easy is it? But Crowley said that it doesn't have to do with anything about truly making yourself invisible, but controlling everyone else around you and making them completely uninterested in making eye contact with you or noticing you in any way. So
I've already figured
Crowley's
that out.
Idea,
then.
Yeah. I'm really good at that.
Yeah.
But Crowley's idea of invisibility was just to blend in to the point that people don't notice you.
Yeah.
Okay. So he says once he figured out how to do it, he could gauge by the faintness of his own reflection. So he doesn't even pay attention to himself. He could put on his red robes and his golden crown and walk the streets of Mexico, and no one would ever make eye contact with him or initiate a conversation now.
Yeah.
Let me ask you.
I know why.
You're walking down the street, and there's a guy wearing red robes and a gold crown.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to make eye contact and start talking with this guy?
I'm not looking at that fool either.
I'm looking the other direction because I'm like, please, God, don't ask me anything.
Yep, Don't talk to me.
I ain't got time for your craziness today. So maybe, just maybe, if you're just so outlandish, it's not that people are uninterested. People ignore you.
Yeah, they legitimately don't want to look at you. That's.
But according to Crowley, that made him invisible.
Well, then I've learned to be invisible since my high school years. I'm really good at that.
But all of this work led him to continue his philosophy and his teaching and his study, and pushed him toward his eventual goal, which was to create his own theology.
Right.
Which was, as Adam mentioned before, was called Thelema. And Adam, tell us a little bit about Thelema, because I know you did a lot of research on this.
Yeah, probably more than I should have for my own mental sake. But so Thelema or Thelema is a Greek word meaning will or intention. And that plays a big part in his religious beliefs around this time. Now, one of the earliest mentions of Thelemic philosophy occurs in the classic Gargantua and Pantagruel, which was written by Francois Rabelais, I think, Rebelais, in 1532. In 1904, while traveling in Egypt with his wife Rose, Crowley became inextricably involved in a series of events which he claimed to inaugurate a new eon of human evolution. Now, these culminated in April when Crowley entered a state of trance and wrote down the three chapters of 220 verses, which came to be called the Book of the Law, which, among other things, this book declared, quote, "The word of the law is Thelema, and, quote, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." And I think we've talked about that statement before in a previous episode.
We have.
So Crowley.
I don't remember which one, but I don't either.
We've talked about it so often. But Crowley spent the rest of his life developing the system of Thelema as revealed by the Book of the Law. Now, the result was a huge output of commentary and works relating to magic, mysticism, yoga, Kabbalah, and other occult subjects. Now, virtually all of his writings bear the influence of Thelema as interpreted and understood by Crowley in his capacity as prophet of the new eon. Now, one theory holds that each chapter of the Book of the Law is associated with a particular eon of human spiritual evolution. Now, according to this view, chapter 1 characterizes the eon of Isis, when the archetype of female divinity was paramount. Chapter 2 relates to the eon of Osiris, when the archetype of the slain god became prominent and the world's patriarchal religions became established. Chapter 3 brings in the dawning of a new eon, the eon of Horus, the child of the Isis and Osiris. Now, it's this new eon that Thelema will fully be revealed to humanity, and it will become established as the primary paradigm for the spiritual evolution of the species. So basically, what he's saying is that his writings are like a history lesson for us. Chapter 1 and chapter 2 are the history lessons, and chapter 3, the new eon, the eon of Horus, is what we're living in now, and it's basically our guide to live by. And it's not widely known yet, because part of this new eon is to release that knowledge to all of the human race.
Right. And you may wonder, what in the world would make Crowley just decide he's going to write this Book of the Law? Where was his inspiration? Now, according to Crowley, he was approached and directed to write this by Iwas, who Crowley claimed was a minister of Horus, who, like Adam said, he's the central deity in Thelema. Now, Crowley describes this inspiration or this intervention from Iwas in a later book called The Equinox of the Gods. And this is what he says. He says, "The voice of Iwas came apparently from over my left shoulder, from the furthest corner of the room. It seemed to echo itself in my physical heart in a very strange manner, hard to describe. I have noticed a similar phenomena when I have been waiting for a message fraught with great hope or dread. The voice was passionately poured, as if Iwas were alert about the time limit. The voice was of deep timbre, musical and expressive. Its tones solemn, voluptuous, tender, fierce, or aught else as suited the moods of the message." Now, he says it wasn't a bass voice, meaning maybe like a tenor or a baritone. It's curious that he goes on and on about, you know, I'm really giving you
very
a short
detailed
passage as to how he describes this voice. But he does go on to describe Iwas' appearance. He says he was transparent like a veil of gauze. He said his dress was Persian, and Crowley believed him to be an angel like he had seen in his visions, but definitely an astral being.
Mm-hmm.
So, oddly enough, in the book Magic in Theory and Practice, Iwas is identified by Crowley as, quote, the devil, Satan, and Lucifer. Now, it's important to note that the devil didn't mean the same to Crowley. He saw the devil as an angel of God who brought the power of self-will to humans, essentially making gods out of themselves. Yet even those that knew Crowley suspected that Iwas was merely an extension of his own consciousness. You know, he just, not necessarily that he just made him up, but that,
like a tulpa, basically.
Kind of, you know, it was this voice rattling around in his head telling him, oh, you need to write this and this and this. You know, everybody's had that. You know, you get that inner monologue and it almost mm-hmm. sounds like you're talking to yourself in a different voice, directing what you're going to do. And that's what a lot of people felt that Iwas was, that he believed this voice that was in his head was actually an astral being. But as Adam's talking about, the Book of the Law would serve as the central text behind Thelema, and further promoting Crowley's "do what thou wilt" philosophy.
So let's take a look at some of the points of the Book of the Law and just kind of get a general summation of some of the things that are in there, so you kind of have an understanding of his mindset and what he was wanting to portray. One of them is, every man and every woman is a star. So this is usually taken to mean that each individual is unique and has their own path in a spacious universe where they can move freely without collision. So you see right there, it's starting the taking yourself as the a unique individual who has power, and that holds through most of his writings. Your power within you is the main power.
Yeah. To Crowley, the most powerful being in the universe was you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
You were no more powerful than anyone else, but you were the most powerful for your own individualism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's why all of his writings push that self-will. And again, it goes back to that "do what you wilt." It's this whole idea of it's your life, you know, make the absolute most of it. You know, this is the power within you. You just have to learn how to tap into it.
Exactly. So on that note, "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, and thou hast no right but to do thy will." So this is a continuation of what we were just talking about. Most Thelemites hold that every person possesses a, quote, true will, a single overall motivation for their existence. Now, the law of Thelema mandates that each person follow their true will to attain fulfillment in life and freedom from restriction of their nature. Now, because no two true wills can be in real conflict, this law also prohibits one from interfering with the true will of any other person. So that's kind of like my saying, I don't give a crap what you do as long as it doesn't negatively affect me. That,
right.
It's pretty much that.
Which, you know, what other religion do we know that preaches this exact thing? Satanism.
Yep. Yep. Very true.
The idea that you live your life, do whatever you want, and it's perfectly fine as long as you don't interfere with someone else living their life.
Right.
You know,
right.
Which, you know, that we're not going to get into Satanism, but that's what Satanism is at its core.
Right. It's misunderstood.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you do what you want to do. If this makes you happy, if you want to do this, then by all means do it, as long as you're not, you know, harming or interfering with someone else doing the same thing.
Yep. Yep.
You know, just living their life.
Yep. Exactly. Well, the notion of absolute freedom for an individual to follow his or her true will is a cherished thing amongst the Thelemites. Now, the main task of an individual setting out on the path of Thelema is to first discover his or her true will, giving methods of self-exploration such as magic great importance. Now, every true will is different, and because each person has a unique point of view of the universe, no one can determine the true will for another person. Each person must arrive at the discovery for themselves. So there's no way that I could tell Matt what his true will is, or he could tell me, because it's a self-discovery. Because Matt may know me, but he doesn't know me like I know myself. So,
right.
You know, we both would have to go on our own exploration of what our true will is in order to develop the rest of our lives and extend this thought throughout the rest of our lives.
Yeah, this always reminds me of the cartoon where the guy is climbing the mountain, you know, he's by this tremendous journey and he gets to the top of the mountain and there's this, you know, this meditating old man, long white beard, and he's like, oh, you know, great teacher, what is the meaning of life? And, you know, he says something, you know, along the lines of, you know, look into your own self. And, you know, that's kind of what it's saying.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, you've sought me out to tell you what the meaning of your life is.
Right.
It's inside of you is what this is saying. You know, there's no reason to go search someone else out because they're not going to be able to tell you.
Right. Take that.
You have to figure it out yourself.
Take that mountain climb internally. It's something you've got to do all for yourself.
And I mean, how many different theologies have we seen over the centuries that follow something along these lines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not out of the norm by any stretch.
Truly exploring your own self and learning, you know, you self-love and you know, self-reliance and, you know, you're your own best person and all this other stuff. I mean, we've seen that in you know, Eastern religion, you know, for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in reality, this is not a new concept.
No.
He's putting his own spin on it.
Right. He's wording it in a different way. Now, the last one we'll touch on is love is the law, love under will. Now, this is a very important corollary to what we just talked about, indicating that the essential nature of the law of Thelema is that of love. Now, each individual unites with his or her true self in love, and so empowered, the entire universe of conscious beings unites with every other being with love. Now, with the emphasis on freedom and individuality inherent in Thelema, the beliefs of any given Thelemite are likely to differ from those of any other. In the comment appended to the Book of the Law, it is stated that, quote, all questions of the law are to be decided only by appeal to my writings, each for himself. Now, although Thelema is definitely a quote-unquote religion, it's a new kind of religion, one which accommodates a full range of individual beliefs from atheism to polytheism. So, in Thelema, you decide for yourself if you're atheist, agnostic, you know, worship one true God, worship a pantheon of gods. It's up to you. As long as you're following the book of the law, you can do any of these things that you wish. So it is truly an all-encompassing quote-unquote religion for everybody. And, you know, it hard for me to call it a religion, but that's what it is defined as.
Seems like more like a philosophy.
Yeah, pretty much. Because it says the important thing is that each person has the right to fulfill themselves through whatever beliefs and actions are best suited to them, so long as you don't interfere with others. Again,
yeah.
And so, only they themselves are qualified to determine which these are.
Yeah, sounds okay so far, right?
Right, sounds fine.
Nothing too crazy.
No, not yet.
Nothing too outlandish. Not yet. But Crowley goes on in the Book of the Law to discuss, you know, some current issues in politics and society, and he makes some predictions. One of which is, you know, the rise of the new age, or the eon would lead to the eventual fall of society as it was known at the time. And this is what would lead into the new age. Now, He discusses communism, socialism, fascism, and capitalism, and he details his views on the pros and cons of each one. Now, Crowley was really against any kind of, you know, communalism of any kind. It reduced the power of the individual. But he wasn't really an anarchist, at least not a true anarchist. He saw potential in each of these systems, but was quick to point out their shortcomings. Now, some interesting things about Crowley's New Age and what he sought to happen in the New Age was the equality of the sexes, you know, women's liberation, feminism, all of this, sexual freedom, you know, the lack of persecution for your sexual orientation.
He was way ahead of his time on all that.
He was in these ideas, because this was something that nobody was even thinking about, you know, at that time.
I mean,
we're talking about
early 1900s.
You know, the early 1900s. I mean, you know, a different sexual orientation. I mean, you would be cast out mm-hmm. of society. I mean, you know, you people lost jobs, livelihoods, sometimes even imprisoned
mm-hmm.
because of a different sexual orientation. You know, and he was talking about this New Age. You know, everybody, you can be free to do whatever it was you wanted.
Right.
You know, non-discrimination or non-differentiation, as he calls it. Free association, which means that you could get together with whoever you wanted, whenever you wanted, and discuss whatever topic it was you wanted. Because, you know, at the time, under governments, you know, like with communism and fascism, you know, associations were not permitted.
I mean, sure.
You could, if you had a group of people that gathered together to discuss anything, that was against the law, because you might be plotting against the government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may be developing a plan against the Fuhrer or something like that. He's talking about free association, the ability to discuss whatever you want with whomever you want.
Right.
Universal prosperity and personal autonomy. You know, being able to govern yourself, being able to decide what's right and wrong for you. You know, if you feel like that drinking alcohol is wrong, then that's okay. If you think that, you know, consuming alcohol was perfectly fine and was a natural part of life, that's okay too. And under his ideals, you can't tell him that he's wrong, and he can't tell you that you're wrong.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, according to the law, whatever it was you thought was right for you, then that was perfectly okay. And furthermore, the law said you had to follow that.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what your true will said about you, then that's what you had to do.
Okay, so in 1919, Crowley ended up leaving New York, where he was living, to move to Cefalù, Sicily, where he began to paint landscapes. Now, he transformed his rented villa by painting erotic wall murals after the example of Paul Gauguin, who was one of Crowley's heroes. This was his Abbey of Thelema, an experiment in spiritual monasticism. Now, students traveled to Sicily from around the world to, quote, find their true wills, or like we've said, their purpose in life. Now, Crowley's training regimen involved breaking down all artificial and societal inhibitions to liberate the essential self, while simultaneously giving training in yoga, concentration, and self-analysis. Now, the abbey and its residents prospered, but when an Oxford undergraduate died at the abbey from drinking local water, which Crowley told him not to drink, the British press attacked Crowley relentlessly. Now, the Home Secretary Joyston Hicks and his press mouthpiece James Douglas of the Sunday Express demonized Crowley. The press depicted him as, quote, the wickedest man in the world, and, quote, a man we'd like to hang. Now, ironically, this campaign is what ensured Crowley's enduring fame.
Yeah, that's right. By tagging him with this nickname, they virtually ensured that he would be talked about for, you know, decades after.
Sure. Well, it's so, like telling your kid, yeah, you do not do this. Your kid is going to want to go do this. So you mm-hmm. name Crowley the wickedest man in the world, people are going to go, well, what is this Crowley guy all about?
Right. And, you know, another name that Crowley gave himself was the Beast 666, mm-hmm. Which, of course, is a reference from, you know, the great beast in Revelation. So he embraced that idea that society thought of him as the wickedest man in the world.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know. You make your own decisions on that if you look in there. I mean, I don't know that he was necessarily an evil person. I mean, he wasn't running around hurting people, although, you know, when we talked about Crowley in our Curse of the Mummy episode,
mm-hmm.
you know, there is a theory that Crowley was the one that was going around killing or having killed all these people and attributing to the Curse of the Mummy because of the time that he spent in Egypt.
Right.
And because Egypt was where he supposedly communed with Iwas and he wrote the Book of the Law, Egypt held a very sacred point for Crowley. And so he viewed the exhumation of King Tut as a sacrilege.
Sure.
You know, it was a desecration. And so it would make sense. And, you know, a lot of people have gone as far as to actually track his location in correlation with those deaths that were attributed to the Curse of the Mummy. So if you haven't listened to that one, go back because it's a pretty interesting theory.
Yeah, it really is.
But Crowley's teachings, they endured because with all of this press, people wanted to know more about him. They wanted to meet him and talk to him. They wanted to read his writings and they wanted to hear what his ideas were. And I mean, and his teachings weren't all just New Age mumbo jumbo. And, you know, like we mentioned at the top, you know, his followers that not only grew in number, they grew in stature. You know, a couple in particular, we'll talk about Jack Parsons, who was a pioneer in the field of rocket propulsion and NASA's Jet Propulsion Labs. Say that fast. But he also influenced L. Ron Hubbard. I think everybody knows that name, who at the time was really just a small-time science fiction writer.
Right.
But would later found the Church of Scientology.
Yep.
Now, it's interesting to note that Crowley considered Hubbard to be a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really upset at Hubbard when he and Parsons paired up together to kind of further their own occultist agenda.
Yeah, I always thought that was funny. Reading that, I just thought that was interesting. It's like two competing religions there, you know?
And you know, what Parsons and Hubbard did together, I mean, another episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
What they joined up to do or what they say they were able to do is pretty fantastical. And you may even look for a Patreon episode about that in particular, because that is a really insane story.
Oh, dude, it's wild.
About what these two guys, you know, did. And what was funny is they were proud of it and wanted Crowley to be a part of it. You know, he thought they were idiots for even trying what they did.
Right.
But when you look into Crowley's teachings on self-awareness, it's like we said before, it's easy to see his inspiration from ancient religious practices and his influence in even modern day spiritualism. like yoga, for example. Adam mentioned that he was a yogi. Now, yoga, of course, has been widely practiced for centuries as a form of meditation and self-exploration, and it was praised by Crowley.
And it's great for your core strength.
Hey, exactly. I need to start doing yoga.
You and me both.
I am one of the most inflexible human beings you will ever meet. I am like stiff.
Yeah.
If you look at things that don't bend, you get like a poker, like a 2x4, like one of those iPhones, and then there's me.
And a mat, yeah.
Like, none of them really bend all that much.
I just need to do it for the meditation. I've been wanting to get into meditation, and I think it would be a good way to kind of get into that, you know. It would give me... Because I'm ADD, it would give me something to do while I'm meditating, you know?
Because God forbid you just do focus on one thing.
Yeah, you know, I can't.
If I'm going to do this yoga, I've got to have something else to do while I'm doing
this. Right, right. I got to be doing something else while I'm doing this.
Get you some downward dog there.
Family show.
Now, according to... A family show, that's right. So, according to Crowley, nothing really exists without... other things. Now, in his, you know, his writings on yoga, he gives an example of cheese. I love this example. This sounds like something I'd make up. Now, Crowley says that cheese doesn't really have any qualities by itself because every person that tries it might see something different. But we don't have those qualities in us. Because without the cheese, we're nothing. It's only when we meet the cheese that magic happens. And yoga is a way of connecting our minds and our subconscious with the world around us.
I have been telling Ashley that about cheese for years. That is why I love cheese. I put it on everything because without the cheese, I am nothing.
That's right. Without cheese, I am nothing. I need a shirt that says that. Just so people will ask me, what the hell does that mean?
Yep. I think we found our new graveyard merch, Matt. Without the cheese, I am nothing. Aleister Crowley.
Man, if we made half the t-shirts we talk about making on this show.
Oh, dude. We'd have our own store.
We'd have our own store. But... This idea, what he's saying is that because, you know, if Adam tries a cheese and I try the same cheese, we each have a different experience with the cheese. But by itself, the cheese is nothing. It's just there. You know, it doesn't have any significant quality until you interact with it, until you taste it. Okay. And so what Crowley is saying is that humans are like this too, that without the world around us, you know, we're just kind of here. So you have to experience the world around us in order to fully realize your own qualities, essentially.
I get that.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get that. I don't know why he used cheese as an example. But,
I don't either.
I mean,
but I loved it.
Oh yeah,
I mean, he could have used anything. He chose cheese.
I love cheese, and I love the fact that his quote has cheese. And I am writing down new graveyard shirt. Without the cheese, I am nothing.
Yeah. So if we go back, remember we're talking about yoga. We've gotten into cheese, but
ADD brain.
He says, yeah, "That's right." He says everything about us. Is yoga. For he says it's only through yoga that we truly experience anything. And those that practice yoga on a regular basis and in the right way, he says that these four things will eventually happen. Now, dig this. The first one is perspiration. You're going to sweat.
Okay. All right.
Hot yoga.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any yoga then, I do is hot, Matt.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to see that video. You doing yoga.
New Patreon episode. All right.
Yeah. This is Adam doing yoga. So first you start to sweat. Then you get a spasm in your body that causes all of the muscles to go rigid. Now, wait. I don't want to. I'm rigid enough as it is. I don't need to be any more rigid.
Yeah, you were trying to get less rigid.
I want to do yoga so I can loosen up. Now, after that, he says there'll be a third stage of what he calls Bukhari City, which is sort of a weird phenomenon of jumping around like a frog.
Okay.
Most people they've seen this and they don't realize what they've seen. If you've ever seen like a yoga master, especially like Middle Eastern, they do this thing where their legs are kind of in the lotus position,
mm-hmm.
and they bounce up and down
sure.
on their butt. So they look kind of like, you know, a pogo stick, you know, they're just kind of bouncing up and down.
Right.
So it leads to the fourth stage, which is levitation.
Okay.
So you just start hopping up and down and eventually you don't come down.
All right.
Okay. Now, Crowley even said that he'd never seen it happen. But people had told him that they had seen him levitating.
Oh, really?
So he's never seen anybody levitate, but people tell him that he does it.
Well, he didn't see himself do it. There wasn't a mirror around. You know, and if we go back, if we go back to the beginning of the episode, he doesn't even pay attention to his own reflection. So
that's right. So he can't even see himself. He's invisible.
Right.
He's invisibly levitating. So how did these other people see him?
I guess he didn't have on his red robe.
So, now we kind of go from this. Like I said, it gets a little weirder. I mean, you know, we got it. We can't talk about the Book of the Law, Crowley's teachings, Thelema, without talking about magic.
Sure.
And Crowley claimed that he was a magician. And interestingly enough, Crowley spelled magic with a K at the end. And the reason he did this is because magic with a C, he said, was like a parlor trick, you know, sleight of hand, you know, pick a card, any card. You know, anybody could learn to do that. It's a trick, you know. It
right.
There's nothing really happening there other than someone is fooling you. Now, he used the K at the end to separate tricks from what he called actual magic.
Right. So what he called actual magic was the Solomonic magic that we talked about before. A lot of people often refer to it as black magic, which I don't necessarily see that, but that's one of the ways it's been described. This talks about a complex system for invocation of angels and demons and for achieving changes in nature by operating through them. Now, this is the sort of magic that is often represented by the use of spells, incantations, and rites. Now, the Enochian language, or, quote, the language of the angels, the Kabbalah, the Geisha, the sigils, and other oracular systems such as the runes comprise the theoretical basis for articulating an intention and its operative resonance in nature. Now, curiously, however, all the arcane science did not figure into what Crowley himself considered true magic. If anything, he encouraged his pupils to learn all the theory they could, only to get rid of it later. For him, magic was fundamentally a psychological system meant to conduct human will towards a complete command over his individuality. So, magic for him was all intention. You learn this system, the systems of magic and the theory and all that, but it's only so you don't do that. And
right.
I'm a big believer in intention on things, where if you put out enough intention into the universe, then the universe usually will reciprocate with that intention, basically. You know, if you're wanting something to come to fruition, put out those vibes, for lack of a better right. term, you put out those vibes into the universe and you say, this is what I want to achieve, and you're more likely to achieve it than if you go the other way. You know, you don't be negative about, oh, I'm never going to achieve this. Well, then you never will. Believe and you can, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like the dress for the job you want, not the job you have.
Yeah,
you
know? Pretty much.
put out some positive vibes, y'all.
Oh, so, yeah.
But so how do you get to this point? Well, Crowley used family show. So if y'all hear me talk about this, you don't got to flip the radio off. We're gonna be, you know, PG.
Edited for graveyard listening.
Crowley used what he called sex magic. Now, like I said, without going into all of the sordid details, this is essentially a way to achieve complete physical exhaustion through sex in multiple forms to reach what Crowley called erotocomatose lucidity. Now, in this state, the body is exhausted and the spirit is exhilarated, leaving a person in a not asleep but not awake state, allowing them to experience and commune with divine spirits. So essentially his idea is that you have to, the body will interfere.
Sure. We've talked about that before. In other things, your body gets in the way.
Right. And so for this, same deal. If you can completely exhaust your body, then it lets your mind open up. Your mind no longer has to worry about what your hand is doing or what your leg is doing. And this was how you achieved it, was through complete exhaustion.
Right.
So he goes on to talk more about the use of magic. And according to Crowley, the magical phenomena are made up of six things: touch, taste, smell, sight, sound, and the mind. Now, the first five, depending on how they're stimulated, will cause changes in the brain, which are then manifested as magical results. So, again, what Adam was talking about, the intention of what you're doing can produce the desired result. Now, once the mind processes what it's receiving from the senses, it projects the results back into the physical world. And that means that all the demons and devils come right from the mind of the person conjuring them. So the portal to conjure these demons and astral beings is you.
Right.
You're channeling them, you know, into your world. Now, he goes on to say that each demon is associated with certain signs, seals, and names. And the names are essentially vibrations which stimulate a part of the brain and allow the caster to control the part that's associated with that particular demon. Okay? So, if you're looking to summon a demon that's going to help you with, you know, this example is math homework, you would use the sights and smells that stimulate the logic part of the brain while saying the words that stimulate the same part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, if you have writer's block, okay, then you would use the sights and the sounds and the smells that would stimulate the creative parts of your brain. And then you would say the words that would also stimulate the creative part of your brain. And essentially, you're summoning a demon that will help you cure your writer's block.
Right, right.
Okay.
Which all of that seems fairly logical when you think about it in this sense. In order to achieve something, You put all of your intention into it, and you say whatever words or sounds that associate with that, and it will come to fruition. It all goes hand in hand.
Yeah. It's just the idea that Crowley had that these demons were going to come and help you achieve these goals. Mm-hmm. So his idea of summoning demons is not bringing about hell on earth or total devastation.
Right, right.
You know, it's bringing these demons into your mind that helps you as the individual. And you call upon specific ones for specific tasks.
Right. So, again, it's a very self-centered religion and task.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, that's the lemma in a nutshell. I mean, that, and, you know, understanding that and understanding, you know, the idea of the self-will, individualism, and the use of magic, and yet you understand Aleister Crowley. You understand what he was about. And, you know, like Adam and I have talked about, how these things draw from ancient religious practices and, you know, how we see their influence in modern day spiritual practices, you can understand that he was developing followers that were 100% buying into this and actually do today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Thelema is still around today. You know, people still follow these teachings. And again, it's just this idea of, you know, through, you know, the proper channels, you can, you know, essentially master your own self and be able to achieve anything you want. So,
yep. And not much, you know, of that seems too crazy.
Right. You know, now this idea of all this magic, you know, it depends on how open your mind is to this idea of the magic. I mean, you know, is it really magic is what we're thinking about? You know, what I think most people think of when they think of magic is that you can, you know, move stuff and make stuff disappear and, you know, you have some kind of, you know, mystical power. But it seems like in Crowley's teaching, you know, it's not about, you know, shooting lightning bolts out of your hands.
Right.
You know, it's the magic is that true will, you know, that ability to harness, you know, your inner self and achieve what your true will wants you to achieve.
Right. And his idea of magic is completely different than what, you know, Wicca magic would be or pagan magic would be considered and how they would look at it. It's, you know, it's not the spells and the incantations and stuff, yet he incorporates some of that chanting into his right. his thing, but the outcome is different. It's not to create or influence something without. It's totally to influence something within.
Exactly.
So the magic is internal, and the magic is for you and only you.
Yeah. So we're not, you know, we're not telling you, hey, go out and convert to Thelema.
Right.
You know, we're trying to help everyone understand a little bit more, but who this character was and how unique he was, especially for the time where he lived. You know, so, I mean, everybody's heard, you know, most people know, or they, at least when they hear it, they go, oh yeah, I've heard that. I mean, you know, Ozzy Osbourne included him in songs, Led Zeppelin, you know, a lot of rock bands from, you know, the 60s and 70s were into Crowley's teachings and the occult and things like that. And we're going to get into that here in just a second. But I don't think that we could talk about Aleister Crowley without getting into some of the things that he may have caused and left behind. And when you start looking at Aleister Crowley, his home, or at least one of them, inevitably will come up. And what we're talking about is the Bowleskin House. And it has probably the most, one of the most interesting stories about Aleister Crowley. And, you know, as I was doing the research, I told Adam, I said, we can't not talk about this. You know,
right.
We have to discuss this because it's too incredible, you know, to not talk about it. So the Bowleskin House was a Scottish mansion that was owned by Crowley near the turn of the 20th century. Now, the mansion itself was built in the 1760s at the site of a former church that was said to have caught fire during a service, killing the entire congregation.
Well, if that's not some juju put into that ground.
I'm telling you. Yeah, let's build a house here.
Yeah.
Seems like a bad idea there.
Right.
But okay, you do you. But Bowleskin was purchased by Crowley in 1899. Crowley bought it for the explicit purpose of conducting a six-month ritual that was designed to summon demons.
Mm-hmm.
So during the ritual, he did a lot of meditation. He practiced celibacy, which was kind of, and abstinence, which was way out of character for Crowley.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially, you know, he was into these psychedelic drugs and, you know, he was all over the place sexually. So this seemed a little out of the norm. And for that reason, a lot of people thought it was too much and he couldn't complete it. Because after that, he just kind of took off to Paris.
Yeah.
So, it's believed that he never really completed any of the spell that would have brought about it. Or did he?
Yeah.
Did he complete it and just go, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe he was ADD too and got bored with it.
He's standing there, you know, with his hands on his hips. My work here is done. Off to Paris.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. We'll just leave this here.
Yeah, but I mean, but even Crowley admitted later that, you know, at least one of his experiments had gone really, really wrong. Okay. And the story grew that he had conjured these demons and just left them in that house. Okay. But there was a series of tragedies in the house, including the deaths of the housekeeper's children. And when I say housekeeper, I mean like this was a caretaker.
Right.
Took care of the house when Crowley was away. But some of the strange things that he did there, one of them is he supposedly threw sacrificial sheep into the lock every Sunday for his pet, air quotes, Nessie.
Ah. Feeding Nessie.
Now we're getting into the weird.
Yeah, right.
Not only was Crowley kind of a weirdo, he was throwing sheep into the lake to feed Nessie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But a few years later, Crowley managed to sell the house, which passed through various owners over the next few decades. One of these was Major Edward Grant, who died in 1965 after committing suicide in the occultist's former bedroom. So right in Crowley's bedroom, this guy shoots himself. The house was then bought by a married couple whose marriage broke up shortly afterwards. Then it was purchased by Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page in 1970. Now, Page wanted the house because he thought it would be inspiration for songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
But like we said, you know, he was really just one of the rock stars from this time frame that was influenced by Crowley. But the idea of, you know, sex and drugs just kind of went along with rock and roll.
Sure.
So, In fact, you know, we mentioned this on one of the Patreon episodes. It's kind of a little clue as to what we were going to talk about this week. You know, Crowley is one of the figures on the cover of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album cover.
Right, right.
And David Bowie references Crowley in the song Quicksand. So, you know, like I said, he was a big influencer in you know, rock musicians, you know, in the 60s and 70s. But Jimmy Page's interest ran a good bit deeper. Page financed a bookshop that called Equinox, which he named after Crowley's book, The Equinox of the Gods. And he stocked it with a number of rare and very expensive books on the occult. Now, Page also collected Crowley memorabilia, and he asked other members of Led Zeppelin to join him in a ritual based on the occultist writings to propel the band to greater success. Now, it's said that all the members of the band took part in the ritual, with the exception of John Paul Jones, mm-hmm. who was kind of the straight-laced one of the group.
Right.
Now, the band's album started to reference Crowley, and in 1972, Page wrote the soundtrack for a film called Lucifer Rising. Now, the director of this film was Kenneth Anger. Now, he was another Crowley follower and ritualistic magic practitioner. Now, Anger and Page had a falling out, which caused Anger to curse Jimmy Page.
Oh, Lord.
Okay. Now, remember, this is how this ties in. Page is living in Crowley's house. Okay. And there's even a story where one night Jimmy Page had this unreal experience where the whole house was shaking and he felt like he couldn't move. And he thought at any moment that the spirit of Aleister Crowley was going to explode right through his bedroom door and confront him for all of this stuff he had been, you know, trying to do inside this house. There's also a story. I heard this on another show where he got David Bowie involved in one of these little rituals, and it freaked David Bowie completely out to the point that he really didn't want to have anything to do with Jimmy Page anymore. And they were close. They were buds.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, whatever Page was up to inside Crowley's house, it not only freaked him out, it freaked other people out too.
Well, and a quick aside, since we're talking about the house and some of the stuff that went on there, we mentioned Hellier earlier, and it's kind of a synchronicity that I heard this recently before we recorded this episode. They talked about in there during the 70s, somebody theorized that while Crowley was performing the ritual in his house that opened the door to the demons and everything, that this also opened a door to be able to allow the alien greys into our planet. So we didn't have alien greys up until this portal or whatever was opened. And then from that point on, the greys were prevalent on Earth. Take of that what you will. I just thought it was interesting that Matt and I are researching Crowley, and mm-hmm. I'm also watching Hellier, and then they mention Crowley and alien greys in that episode.
Right, yeah. And, you know, there's that the whole idea that all aliens are actually demons.
Mm-hmm.
All demons are actually aliens.
Right. We're looking at aliens the wrong way, basically.
Yeah, essentially. So, you know, it's interesting tie-ins when you start digging into these tie-ins.
There are so many Crowley tie-ins to everything.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially when you're talking about the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of use of psychedelic drugs, you know, a lot of attitude changes from, you know, the government's great and we're all this big community to, and just just live your life and do what you want and, you know, be kind to one another and all this. I mean, all those, they kind of fall into, you know, what Crowley was talking about. But Kenneth Anger, being another Crowley follower and a practitioner, decided that he could curse Jimmy Page over this, you know, riff that they had. And shortly after that curse, Robert Plant and his family nearly died in a car crash in Greece. But the crash resulted in the cancellation of the band's Physical Graffiti tour and delayed the release of their next album. Now, the next tour also experienced a lot of bad luck when Robert Plant suffered laryngitis, causing fans to riot and creating more strife between the band members. In 1977, Plant's son Carrick died, and this was followed by the death of John Bonham in 1980, which essentially marked the end of Led Zeppelin. So, you know, all of this started for the band when Page bought this house and started digging into all this stuff.
Sounds like, you know, that curse might have worked.
It led him to work with Kenneth Anger and then caused him to be cursed, if you believe in curses. But it was odd that, you know, Led Zeppelin was on the rise. And the whole idea behind Page doing any of this was just to achieve the absolute pinnacle of success for Led Zeppelin. I mean, that's what his focus was in all of this. But while Page was gone, he had left the house in the care of a friend named Malcolm Dent. Now, Malcolm claimed he had had a lot of weird experiences in Crowley's old house. Doors would slam shut and open mysteriously. Furniture would move around. Rugs and carpet apparently rolled up of their own accord. You know, and Dent frequently heard odd rumblings at night, but suffered what he said was the most terrifying night of his life when he was wakened by the noises of a wild animal outside of his bedroom door. He said after that, whatever was out there was pure evil. Now, the house is still there, and it was sold in 1991 to Annette and Ronald McGilvray, and they turned it into a hotel and pretty much dismissed any talk that there was any strange or paranormal activity going on there at all. Now, it was converted back into private ownership, but suffered significant damage in a 2015 fire. Then it was purchased by London-based lawyer Kyra Reddy and a property developer named Keith Reddy, and a foundation was set up for its restoration. But yet that restoration has been slowed again by another fire in July of this year. So that's one of these things that I like to talk about when it says the building doesn't want you to do something.
Right, right.
You know,
we've seen that
this,
often.
This building does not want to be changed and restored and messed with and turned into a hotel. It just wants to be left alone. Maybe because there's a portal inside that's letting demons in there, and they've turned it into their clubhouse.
Yeah, right.
Just want to tell everybody, hey, get out of here.
Right.
You know, we don't want you here.
We've seen where restorations and stuff of homes have caused spiritual activity to, I mean, ramp up like crazy. So why would it not on something like this where there's an apparent portal that has been opened and never closed?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, what else would you expect? I mean, you know, it's Aleister Crowley's house.
Right, you know? Right.
I mean, you know, if anybody was going to own a house and turn it into a haunted house, it would be Aleister Crowley.
No kidding.
But yeah, I mean, just such a polarizing individual. And, you know, I think most everybody has this, you know, idea, oh, he was some kind of weird, mystic lunatic and everything. And, you know, maybe he was. But he was interesting enough that his philosophy and his ideas have lasted for centuries. Well, not centuries, decades.
Right.
You know, I mean, we're talking about him here in 2019. You know, Crowley passed away in 1947. And yet, you know, we're still bringing it up. His influence can still be seen. And so Adam and I just kind of wanted to give you guys a little bit better understanding of who he was and what he did and why his teachings would endure for so long.
Right. And why we always seem to talk about the guy. Like, seems like every episode we do, we talk about him. Yeah. And it's because he had his hands in so much. And
right.
You know, like we said, the teachings, for the most part, his Thelema teachings and all that, are not that wild. They're not so crazy that you've never heard it before or never experienced something like that before. It's pretty right. pretty much just an amalgamation of a bunch of different other religious beliefs and teachings. Now, some of the things he did outside of that, they did get a little wild and a little wacky, but you know, his legitimate teachings kind of resonate with people more than I think most want to give them credit for.
Yeah. Yeah. But like we said at the top of the show, we could have given you a biography of Aleister Crowley, including, you know, he was a British spy. You know, he worked as a spy. I mean,
it's,
you know,
because he was invisible.
It's because he was invisible. That's right. Can you imagine him showing up to work as a spy wearing a big red robe and a crown?
Yeah, right. Don't worry. Nobody will see me.
See me. But yeah, he's such an interesting figure. But we, you know, we wanted to focus more on, you know, what he was really all about and why you still hear his name even today. So, I tell you what, I really enjoyed researching him. I learned a lot more than I already knew. And, you know, I had been pestering Adam about doing a show on Crowley for quite some time. And I remember the first time I ever heard of Aleister Crowley, it was in the Ozzy Osbourne song, Mr. Crowley.
Yeah. And what it, they it, done it, to it made, your it, hair.
It made me. It made me go and find out who he was. So I've always had a little bit of interest, and I hope you guys enjoyed hearing more about, you know, Aleister Crowley's ideas and his philosophies and his theology and whatnot.
Right. And but, feel free, you know, to go look more up about him. We'll put our sources in the show notes, and you can find all the stuff that we left out about his biography if you're interested.
Yeah, exactly. So let us know what you think. You know, was Crowley somebody that was on your radar? Did you, you know, I'm sure some of you have stories about him that you've heard over the years. We'd love to hear them, and tell us what you think. But as always, be sure and go check out our website. It's graveyardpodcast.com. And on our website, you can listen to the show. You can find links to buy Graveyard Tales merchandise, find out a little bit more about Adam and myself, and you become a patron. And we appreciate everyone who continues to donate to the show. Mm-hmm. We're all the time mentioning we're putting out Patreon content, and we were just discussing it tonight about, you know, newer things that we can do to freshen it up a little bit. So hopefully we'll be looking at that and in the upcoming year. But check us out on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search Graveyard Tales, and please rate and review us on iTunes. It helps bring us up the charts and makes us easier to find. So,
oh yeah,
that's all I got, Adam. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.